Let's try that again. Good afternoon. It's Eric Scott. It's Monday morning, or Monday afternoon now, I guess. And our regular guest is here with us. He is, you know him, you love him, is, ladies and gentlemen, Wolfboro Police Chief Dean Rondo.
Woohoo! Hey, how you doing, Eric?
How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good.
Hey, Merry Christmas, everybody. Happy Hanukkah. Happy holidays.
Been a couple of weeks since you've been around.
Yeah, you had the V&A in here. That's great. That's a great organization.
Yeah, they are.
Yep.
They are. Tell me something. We were talking right before the airtime. I thought it was me, that there seems to be a whole lot more traffic here than in previous years. I was going to ask you about that. Are there more people here?
Yeah, it's not you. Yeah, you're correct. In astute observation, you're absolutely correct. Place is packed.
And
we are packed.
I still see out-of-state plates.
They're all over the place, yeah. And so what you got going on is you got a couple, two or three things that all come together. As my former chief used to say, what we have here is a serendipitous commingling of events. I love that. So you got a bunch of things happening here all simultaneously. And so let's take a lockstep. So for probably the last 10 years, we've been steadily increasing on this thing that I call information technology. And that's been taken off at leaps and bounds. Now, most of us recognize that from social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, but there's been a lot of other type things happening in the background. You got Google Meetings, you got Apple Play TV, you've got go-to meetings, you've got Zoom meetings, you got all these meeting platforms that have really had been essentially in their infancy and had been starting to be developed. And I remember when I was in Iraq, this is when I was a lieutenant colonel, I was chief of operations and intelligence for a CA brigade supporting 18th Airborne Corps. And this is in 2008 to 2009. And I had the ability in my conference room. We had this huge wall size television, right? Calling it a TV would not be accurate. It was a plasma display. It was mounted on the wall, and once a week, I'd sit down with my brigade commander and my primary staff officers, and we would have. We would have, and it was secure. It was classified, right? We had classified links, and I would have meetings with Pentagon officials. We'd have meetings with our higher headquarters at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and we were in Iraq. And we could have all these other people dial in. So if I wanted to include some of the commanders from what was going on in Afghanistan or distant locations in Iraq. We had this technology, and we could dial in everybody literally around the world. We had at times some of our commands in Africa dialing in because we were tracking on issues that were having these global implications. So we did that once a week. Also, once a week, I'd have a meeting with all the commanders that were serving within our brigade. All across Iraq, so we would synchronize and tie in our operations. Things going on down south in Umm Qasr and Basra and so forth and so on, all the way up to Erbil in Iraq. I was stationed in Baghdad at the time, so we could dial in all these commanders. All right, so that was in 2008. So this technology has just continued to advance, right? And a lot of us probably remember Skype when that first came out.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was cool, right?
I still use Skype.
Yeah, right, sure, right. And Skype is still out there. And so that's where a lot of us really said, there's a lot of capability here. And that started hitting right around 2006, 2007. Well, this technology has advanced. So now what you've got is with GoToMeetings and Google Meetings and all these other connectivities, people can dial in. And then you had COVID-19 hit, right? And all of a sudden, businesses, in order to be safe, number one, and comply with city and state mandates and federal mandates, Everything started going remote, and you know, businesses, you know, were shutting down and sending their employees home. And then these things like GoToMeetings and Apple meetings and Google meetings and so forth and so on, and Zoom meetings and GoToMeetings, which is another platform out there, all began to take shape, and they came on board because businesses were like, we have to conduct operations. We have to continue to try to make money, right? Because we're a capitalist society, right? And that's what keeps everything rolling. And our economy, whether we like it or not, is a capitalist one. So it takes cash flow to keep this animal moving. And when you have a crisis like this, you have innovation. And people said, hey, there are things that we can do. And they came up with these ideas. So all of a sudden, boom, the crisis forced innovation to come to the forefront. And the software programmers and the hardware dudes and dudettes got together, and they created all these platforms and software and hardware that all interacted. And all of a sudden, lo and behold, we could have board meetings right from the comfort of our studies or our offices or our man caves or from your iPhone or on the road or whatever the case may be. And so that happened. And then this other thing happened where, because we were now doing business remotely from home, you had these big office buildings that were going unoccupied. And so we were able to do things like reduce the heat, reduce the electricity, and maybe in some cases even reduce or lower the insurance because our people weren't in the buildings. And the CEOs and the CFOs are looking at the bottom line going, wow, man, we, you know, 90% of our operating capital is designed to pay for the brick and mortar facility that we're in, right? Whether that's the mortgage or the lease or the taxes or the air conditioning or the heating or the oil or the water bill or whatever the case may be. And now all of a sudden you don't have to pay that, or you don't have to pay a vast majority of that, but you still got this hunk of junk, a piece of concrete sitting on Park Avenue somewhere in New York City going, I have this office building that I have two people occupying and 150 of my employees in the Dean Rondeau widget service company are working from home. Why do I need this brick and mortar facility? And that's what you got going on. So you got a lot of brick and mortar facilities that are now out there on the market, because CFOs and CEOs are saying, hey man, we can save 90% on the bottom line of our budget by just getting rid of this thing and just working from home. So now enter here Wolfboro and towns like it all across this nation are seeing this huge influx of people from Boston, Philadelphia, New York City, LA, you know, Worcester, you know, and other places where people now don't have to live and work in the same city, right? Now they can live where they want and dial in, and maybe once a quarter or once every 6 months, you fly to New York City, or you drive to Boston, and you attend a board meeting, or a shareholders meeting, or whatever the case may be, and then you go back to doing business the way you've been doing it, and that's just going to continue to take off, right? Because that makes all the sense in the world. Because if you don't have to pay overhead for a building, for a facility, you save a lot of money. You save a lot of money, because that's a lot of business. If you're a service corporation, a service company, could be anything. You're servicing, like I said, widgets, and you don't have to maintain that facility. That's huge.
So this trend is permanent, you think?
Oh yeah, this is definitely, and it's just going to continue. And it's just going to continue. So what you're seeing, and the reason we're seeing these out of state plates is, you know, so this is funny. You get all these people that are coming up here, and they got Pennsylvania plates, or they got New York City plates, or they got, you know, Mass plates, or whatever. I've even seen a few from Maine and Vermont. And they're here at their second or third home on the lake, or whatever the case may be, and they're choosing to live where they want to live. But yet they're still a resident of Boston, legitimately a resident of Boston, because that's where they maintain their citizenship, right?
Right.
And they just can't give up the Mass played, or the New York City played, or the Pennsylvania played, because that's where, you know, that's to them, that's really home. That's where they grew up, or that's where they went to college, or whatever the case may be. But that will change. That will change. And but that's the reason you're saying a lot of these out-of-state plates. You know, and a lot of people, too, a lot of people said, ooh, you know, the pandemic is moving through New York City, for example. I'm going to get out of here, and I'm going to get out of Westchester County. Westchester. I'm going to get out of Westchester County, and I'm going to head up to Wolfboro, New Hampshire. Or I'm going to leave, you know, the city of Elizabeth, New Jersey. You know, I'm from Jersey. You from Jersey? I'm from Jersey.
I've been to Elizabeth. I don't know anybody who wants to be there.
No, my point exactly. Yeah, what exit? Anyway, they're coming up here because they want to get away from the population density. And they have a legitimate concern to try and stay healthy, right? I would agree with that. So they're going to come up to Wolfboro. So now, interesting, our population density is exploding, right? It's exploding. And we just did the 2020 census. We just got the results back, and I think Wolfboro increased by about 400 people. And so that was eye-opening, right? And I don't think we're at, you know, I've never believed we were at 6,200 people. I always thought we were more close to like 8,000, 9,000 residents in the town of Wolfboro. So going from 6,200 to, say, 6,600, I think is eye-opening for a lot of people. They refuse to believe it, but believe it. And one need only drive down Bay Street and look at the Taylor community, number one. Drive out to Browns Ridge Road and go back to the old Boston and Sand Gravel development that was out there, right, which is a bunch of beautiful homes out there. And they're doing phase two in that project back there. And they're building about another 20 or so four-person units, right? And then you've got the you got another phase of workforce housing going up on Harriman Hill, right? And I want to say that's number two or three or number two or four. That's going to add X number of units. And I know in my development, right, where I live on Winnipesaukee Estates, there's a developer that wants to put in about 25 units, right? And these are going to be big, big houses. These, you know, you're not talking 1,600 square foot homes. You're talking, you know, anywhere from 3,000 to 6,000 square foot homes. These are big homes. And, you know, so you're going to be bringing in, you know, families that are four and five people. So start doing the math on this. And, you know, so, yes, Wolfboro is increasing. And, you know, you could say, well, we've increased artificially. Okay, fine, sure. You know, I'll give you that. We've increased artificially. But we've increased, and we've been increasing. That's the other thing that there's a lot of folks that just refuse to listen or understand, that we have been increasing. This town has always been very active. It's very beautiful. It's well known. It's a bucolic area, and us in Conway, right? Us in Conway, and that's really what it is. It's these are the two big places in Carroll County that people want to live. They want to. You know, for us, right, Wolfboro, it's because of the lake, right? The lake is the big attraction, okay? And aside from the fact that it's a beautiful New England town, it's the lake, right? In Conway, it's the White Mountains, right? So there you have it. That's it. So, no, it's not you.
Okay. What does that mean to the Wolfboro Police Department? Does that affect your staffing? Does it affect your budget?
It will eventually. It won't overnight, but it will eventually. Okay. I mean, there's going to be at some point in time when all these housing developments get put in, it's going to drive the need for additional police officers up. But that's going to happen. That's going to happen.
Have you found an increase in calls for service with the increased population?
So that's an interesting question. I haven't run the calls for service numbers just yet.
Okay.
But we were just looking at, because a request came in from the budget committee, we were just looking at our numbers as of September, October time frame. And I want to say we've had a slight increase in incidents and arrests. Not, you know, when I say slight, I mean very slight, like maybe 2, 3, 5, 10 in that neighborhood. So we're a little bit more than we were, say, last year. Now, remember, last year was a COVID year, so things were a little off. I want to say we're a little bit more than we were in 2019, because that's the last normal year, if you will. Even this year has been a little off. But things have been on a rise, but a very steady, gradual rise, not something that's a tremendous jump. All right, you if you're looking for that, you know, one year you had 200 arrests, the next year you had 400. No, you don't get those tremendous jumps. You go up very slowly by half a dozen to three or four arrests every year, but it's a steady increase. And then there may be a year in there where you drop for some reason, and then you come right back up again.
Right. Yep. And that's due in part to the increased population.
That's due in part to the increased population. It's due to a lot of things. It could be, you know, like, so right now we're involved in this this major investigation of this burglary ring that's been going around and hitting a lot of towns on the periphery of Wolfboro. And sometimes you get these criminal gangs that come from you know, places outside of Wolfboro, and then, you know, that could cause a spike. If you have a gang doing this, for example, that could cause a spike when we finally do arrest people, three, four, five, six, seven people involved in a gang, that can spike the numbers.
Okay. It's like if somebody is breaking into cars, whatever.
That's correct, and that's exactly what this situation is. This is automobile thefts and burglaries and that kind of thing.
While we're on that subject of people breaking the law and getting arrested, I want to talk to you about what's been going on, especially in California, with the mass shoplifting events.
I mean, bad.
There must be a Police Chief Monthly magazine or something.
Oh, there is.
Because every job in the world has a magazine.
Oh, yeah, we have several industry.
I was just wondering
magazines.
If you know what the industry, the law enforcement industry, is saying about this, and what you think you would do if you had that problem.
All right. So first of all, so let's talk about why that problem exists. What you've had in this age of enlightenment that we seem to be in, you've had, I think, politicians and in some cases attorney generals take a step back and say, well, we think we've been doing the wrong thing, and we think that we shouldn't be arresting these people for misdemeanors if they're shoplifting to survive or shoplifting just to subsist. And you've had some states, you know, California is one. I think you've got it in Seattle, Washington, and some other states that have said, well, we're only going to prosecute these shoplifting cases if they're felony level above $10,000 or $5,000 or whatever the case may be, and other than that, we're just not going to prosecute it. Well, so that's what's driving the train here, right? So now it's open season on San Francisco, California. All right, let's look at that city. So that the city decided to change, or the DA decided to change how he or she was going to prosecute those cases, and then the chiefs of police or whatever, or the policy makers, have changed how the police were going to respond to cases like that, and where the police simply aren't even taking a report unless it's a felony level over X number of dollars. And the first thing I would say is I think that's wrong, because you get if you suddenly say, well, we're not going to prosecute you for shoplifting, what do you think is going to happen? You're going to get shoplifters, right?
Okay.
So people are going to walk in and they're going to steal everything they possibly can, especially if they know they're not going to get in trouble for it, right? And then somebody's going to say, whoa, the only people that get hurt are the insurance companies. Well, no, we all get hurt, because what happens is twofold. First, if I'm a franchise owner of a CVS pharmacy or a Rite Aid pharmacy, for example, and we'll just look at that, and I continually get ripped off, you know, or my medicines are stolen or my inventory is stolen, oftentimes right from the back loading dock before I can even put it on the shelves. And I'm filing these claims to my insurance company. Well, after a while, my insurance companies are going to do a couple of things. They're going to increase my rates tremendously, and two, they're going to say, listen, you need to either take precautions and hire security and put in cameras, or we're not going to insure you anymore. Okay? And you may be able to go and get another vendor to insure you, but you're going to have the same conversation with them after about the fifth or sixth claim that you put in for shoplifting. Your rates are going to go sky high, and they're going to say, look, we can't insure you anymore. You're just too expensive. So ultimately, that vendor is say, listen, I can't afford to do business in this neighborhood anymore, so I'm going to leave. I'm going to shut down the shop. I'm going to sell the building, and I'm going to go. So now that community has to deal or has to do without a CVS. Well, somebody's going, okay, big deal. Well, it is if all of your vendors start to leave, and now that community is penalized, and where do you go to get your medicines, or where do you go to get your groceries, or where do you go to get your widgets, or whatever the case may be. So I think you see the domino effect here that the policymakers didn't think about. And the other thing is, look, let's go back to, we live and work in a capitalist society, so it's all about making money. And, if I have a widget service shop and I'm selling widgets at my I'm selling and servicing widgets and I can't keep the front doors open because every time I do, my widgets get stolen. I'm going to eventually pass that cost off to the consumer. So if my insurance rates go up and I have to hire security and put in cameras and put in barricades and do structural changes to my business, well, now instead of a widget being $3.95, now that same widget is going to be $12.68. You see what I'm getting at?
I do.
And that therein lies a problem. And then, so that's at the consumer level. Now, let's look at the governmental level, the governance piece. This is really changing laws like this, and how you enforce laws is really bad. Okay? It's really bad.
Before we get into it, can you at least understand where they're coming from?
I cannot. I understand what they're saying, but I'll get there in a minute. That's a great question. I'll get there in a minute. But let's just talk about the governance piece. So you have a law that you don't like. So you say, well, we're just not going to enforce that law. No. Wrong answer. Okay. We don't get to pick and choose what laws we like and what laws that we're going to enforce and what laws we're not going to enforce. Okay. We just don't, as a society, we don't get to do that. If you want to go to the state legislature, right, at the state level, and say, hey, we don't like this law, let's change it. Well, do it the right way, right? Get with the state legislature and either repeal that law or come up with a compromise that allows you to achieve the desired outcome that you're looking for. Now, I don't think with the plethora, especially in a city like San Francisco, with the plethora, the voluminous number of social programs that are in San Francisco, I can't imagine that people can't get the financial assistance or the food assistance that they need to survive. I know they could get it here in Wolfboro. If they can get it here in Wolfboro, they can get it in San Francisco, California, or without doubt, okay? So I look at, it's one thing to steal a loaf of bread because you're hungry. It's another thing to be stealing iPhone 11s or 12s.
Right.
You're not eating iPhone 11s, all right? You're selling them on the black market, and you're getting money probably for some other nefarious reason, but no, I'm not buying the argument. Well, they're stealing the iPhone because it's easily fenced, and they're taking it and buying food with it. No, they're not. That's not what they're doing. So I think that The shoplifting thing is out of control. It just gets back to the broken windows theory of law enforcement. If you want to drive crime down, then you enforce laws.
Okay. Let's continue with our analogy. I'm the mayor of San Francisco.
Yeah.
You're the police chief.
Beautiful city, by the way.
Yes, it is. I would love to live there if I could afford it.
Oh, it's very expensive.
Yeah, mind-bogglingly expensive.
That and the other one is San Diego.
Oh, God, the weather's just
oh,
so
I know. It's
Diego,
it's awesome there, isn't it?
I have some friends there. And, yeah.
I've been to San Diego. I trained out in that area when I was in the military. Yeah, it's like it's the country's best kept secret, San Diego.
Yeah, it is beautiful.
Yeah.
Anyway,
but get back to what you were saying.
So you're the police chief.
Yeah.
And I'm the mayor. Damn it, I'm not standing for this anymore. I don't want to see mobs in drugstores. Do something.
Yep. Right.
Okay. So now, how does law enforcement address this problem?
So you got to go back to.
I realize there were political tailwinds and all
well,
of that.
Well, you got to look at the DA, right? The district attorney is the lead law enforcement officer for that city, right? And he or she theoretically is working for the attorney general of that state, all right? Mm-hmm. Who the attorney general of that state is a lead law enforcement officer. So sure, the mayor can get mad at the chief of police, and the chief of police is saying, look, we're arresting these people, but the DA isn't prosecuting. So, you know, I don't believe it's a law enforcement issue. It's a prosecutorial issue. They have to be prosecuted. It does no good if I arrest 30 people for shoplifting and the DA doesn't prosecute and releases those 30 people, right? No process the complaints, right? That means withdraws the complaints.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just be back to doing what they're doing because there's no ramifications. There's no consequence to a bad act.
Right, and I understand that. And like I said, I understand where they're trying, what they're trying to do. I'm not necessarily convinced it's the right thing, but they are, and they know a lot more about it than I do.
I don't think it's the right thing. It's gonna end in disaster. You know, when you have laws on the books, you have to enforce those laws. If you don't like the laws, then you get with the state legislature and you propose changes, And I know what people say, well, that takes time, it's not fast enough. Well, yeah, it takes time. That's the whole point. It gives us a chance to hammer out the second and third order effects of what ultimately is going to be policy, right? And what we've had happen here is you've had some policy changes that haven't really been well thought out. Let's take a look at Seattle. And the Chaz zone, right? That was about a year ago. If you remember,
yeah.
You remember what the mayor said? Well, maybe this will be the summer of love, whatever that means, right? And oh yeah, and you had like three or four people that got raped, and people got shot and killed up there, and it was really bad. People were being assaulted. Yeah, so much for the summer of love. Look, you can't change policy like that. You can't turn a blind eye to. Your responsibility as a government to enforce laws. I think people that were harmed in that, you know, either assaulted or sexually assaulted or physically assaulted, or families that had loved ones shot and killed or murdered, whatever the case may be, they have a serious lawsuit against the government. A city municipal government can't abdicate its responsibility to enforce law because you don't like it, because it's distasteful, right? And that's exactly what happened. So when you have laws on the books, you got to enforce them. If you don't like the laws, then you either change them or you repeal them, okay? And that's what you do. And yes, it's a process. And yes, it can be messy. And yes, it can be political. But that's the point. It's a system of government that we have here.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And I know we've talked previously about the broken windows theory. of policing, which you subscribe to.
I do. I yeah, because that works. It's been proven to work. You know, it solves crime. It solves cases. It gets people arrested. You know, gets bad actors policed up.
Well, let's talk about the other end of this, and at least the idea is to keep all of these nonviolent people out of our jails and through our police system. I understand that, but when you have things like, well, you can't enforce expired license plates.
That's stupid.
I think that one in particular is stupid because you know, cities and towns need that money.
That's right. That's a taxation issue.
And you can't just go, oh, okay, I'm not going to do it because the police won't pull me over.
That's exactly what's going to happen.
You know
that. You know there. Yeah, I know. I heard. I saw that. What? So. Yeah, so there are reasons why we have laws on the books, and this is what they're not understanding, right? And it's just unfathomable. I can't imagine being in city government and somebody saying, "Well, we're not gonna do that because it's a crime of nonviolence." Hey, look, we got this thing. This is funny. We got this thing in this state called habitual offender, right?
Oh, yeah. You have to work at it, too.
Yeah, you have to work at it, right? I can't begin to tell you how many habitual offender arrests. It's a felony that I have had, okay? And what it is, folks, is that you're such a bad driver that you're constantly breaking the law, whether it's speed or red lights or DWI or reckless op or negligent op. But Eric is correct, right? You really have to work at it. But there are a lot of people that do a good job at working at it. And they get the points up on their license. And finally, the state says, hey, for whatever reason, you're not getting it. We're declaring you an habitual offender, and you can't drive. We're going to rescind. We're revoking your license, right? Because a license is a privilege.
Right.
Okay. So we're revoking it. And what do? They go out and they drive again. Well, that becomes a felony, right? It's a felony, driving after suspension and habitual offender. So they get arrested. And then it's like 3.5 years in prison.
Is okay. It really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So now you got this person, you know, that's in there with these, you know, cutthroat murderers and rapists. And hey, what'd you do? Oh, I was driving on South Main Street.
Yeah.
You know, so I get it, but what does society do? So we have rules. We have laws that govern our behavior, right? It gets back to what I said. Everything gets back to Rousseau and Hobbes, right? And society has come up with these rules and laws, right? We put them in codes, and you're supposed to follow that. That's what a society follows. Because if you don't, you have anarchy. You have what's going on in Seattle, Washington right now, what's going on in Oregon, what's going on in San Francisco. You have anarchy, right? You have smash and grabs, and no one's getting caught. No one's getting arrested. You have anarchy. All right? That's what you have. And, yes, right? It is distasteful to have to arrest somebody for habitual offender because they don't follow the rules. But you have to do that. There are consequences to bad acts. And it's not like it's a one and done, meaning it's not like, well, you were speeding, so now we're throwing you in prison. No, you really got to work at it. You got to get those points up.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite a few. It's quite a few arrests. It's quite a few speeding tickets and DWIs and everything else. But these bad acts just add up, all right? So when we look at inspections or another one, right, in this state, we inspect our vehicles every year.
Oh, don't get me started.
And there's a real reason for that, right? And generally speaking, when I pull over a car and I write a ticket, and I wrote a lot of these tickets this past year.
Expired stickers?
Yeah, expired inspection and also registration. I got one guy from Pennsylvania, hadn't had his car registered since 2017.
What do you think? You wouldn't? Nobody.
In fact, his car was it, you know, this is funny. Pennsylvania, I had never seen this before. Pennsylvania had and he wanted to argue with me that his plate was, his car was properly registered and that he just hasn't been back to Pennsylvania to get the sticker yet. And I said, okay, so I'll make a deal with you. You know, he came up to, I gave him his ticket, and he came up to the station, wanted to complain. I said, fine, I'm the chief of police. You can complain to me. And I said, so I made a deal with him. I said, look, I will make a deal with you. If I run your plate and it comes back suspended or revoked or some other category, you pay the ticket. But if it comes back properly registered, I'll take the ticket back. Is that fair? Yeah, that's fair. Okay, so I came back dead plate. This thing hadn't been registered in so long that they were declaring it a dead plate. Yeah, unregistered, paid a ticket. Since 2017, you're telling me you've been so busy since 2017, you haven't had a chance to get your car registered? Really?
Especially that a lot of places do it online now.
Yeah, really, you couldn't pick up the phone and give them a debit card number or give them a check or whatever and have them mail you the red, you know, the little stickers. You couldn't do that. Okay, here's your ticket. So, moving on, inspections. Generally speaking, when I pull a car over and give it a ticket, right, for inspection, it's not because it's like one day or 2 days over. You'll get a warning from me in that case. Okay. It's months. I was stopping cars this year that hadn't seen an inspection sticker in 2.5 years.
Wow.
Right. So, generally speaking, when it comes to inspections, there's a real reason why that car doesn't have a sticker, and it's probably because it's unsafe to be on the road. Now, occasionally, I'll run into the little old lady who, you know, her husband passed away and she doesn't know what to do, and in which case, we'll help her get the car inspected, and we'll direct her to the nearest service station and tell her what she has to do and make sure she gets it done, and, you know, we'll work with them. It's called compassion, right? We're not without compassion. But when I get the 30-something that, I've been busy. For the last 2.5 years, you've been busy? I work nights. Okay.
That's even less of an excuse.
Okay, wait right there. I got something for you. So. So these have to be enforced, right? There are reasons why we have this inspection requirement. Yes, for the average Joe and Josephine six-pack out there, doesn't mean that, it's a pain in the backside. We have to go schedule an inspection. Yeah, but there's a very important reason why we do that. And when we just decide to blow it off and we're not going to get it done, well, there are consequences to that decision.
Right. Well, about half of the states don't have periodic inspections.
But we do.
Right, but we do.
But we do, and we live in New Hampshire, and we know what those laws are.
Well, let's look at it from another point of view, and we'll go into the hypothetical. You come up with a law that absolutely makes no sense. For instance, no baby can carry a balloon.
Okay.
Okay. And you're walking down the street, and what do you see? Balloons on a stroller. Okay. You would now have to enforce this law that is probably distasteful.
Mm-hmm.
As a human being, you know, how does that, do you decide to enforce that law, or do you this is a really stupid law?
So we do have many stupid laws, right?
Oh, I'm sure every state has stupid laws.
Every state has dumb laws. The answer is yes. Now, how we enforce it is a matter of this thing called discretion. But let's take your example. Right, as silly as it is, right? Babies with balloons, right? That's against the law. If that is so outrageously goofy, then what should happen is that it should be challenged. right? And either it's challenged constitutionally, which is our custom, or it's challenged through a convention of the state legislature, right?
Right.
We go to our state representative and we say, hey, you know, this is a goofy law and we need to change it. It doesn't make any sense. And we discuss it. And in that discussion somewhere, the logic will come out why we had this law, you know, and maybe it was because, you know, it was an incredibly light baby and the balloon was filled with helium and the baby went off into the stratosphere, right? Who knows? But there'll be some,
right.
There should be some scintillica of logic that we can attach and say, this is the reason why we have this law and we can put our finger on it. And that's it. And then we need to discuss that logic and then, you know, hopefully we can come up with a compromise, right? And that's how things in government get done, is through compromise. But you have to look at the logic, right? And as Justice Scalia said, look, we should never attack people. We should attack ideas, right? He said there's plenty of good people out there with very bad ideas. We should attack the ideas, not people. I agree with that. I know plenty of good-natured, good-intentioned people that have some really bad ideas. And it's the ideas you attack, not the people. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah. And that's just, so getting back to this law with babies and balloons, that's what you do, right? You go at the, and that could have been, you know, some mom, good intention mom, got that thing passed, right? And Moms Against Balloons, there's a lobbying
right.
organization, and they managed to get their point across. Well, maybe we need to look at that and say, well, you know, this isn't really making a whole lot of sense. Maybe we can come up with a better way to do the same thing without having such a restrictive law.
Right.
And that's why we have politicians. That's why we have state legislators, right? You dive into the issues. You look at the second and third order effects rather than making a rash, well, we're not going to prosecute shoplifters. They're just trying to survive. No, they're trying to steal iPhone 11s and sell them on the black market.
Which is hilarious because cell phones are all serial numbered.
Yeah.
Once they're put into the lost or stolen database, you'll never get them activated in a month of Sundays.
Exactly.
You know, a stolen cell phone is worthless.
Yeah, or maybe it's a stolen laptop or
stolen
iPad.
Could
or
be
stolen,
anything.
Stolen anything, right. Yeah. Jewelry, right?
Could be diapers, could be laundry
It could be
detergent.
Diapers, right. You
could
know?
Be baby formula.
Right.
If you have a flash mob at a CVS... And that's another thing.
Could be OxyContin.
Yeah, could be. It could be. What I don't understand is how this all happens. And, I mean, they have video and they have all of this stuff. What can you do about it? As a police officer, is there any way to work on this beforehand? I mean, obviously, you don't know what's coming beforehand, but you know, there's got to be a. I mean, it's the perfect crime.
Well, I wouldn't call
it
the perfect crime. What I would call it is what they're doing is they're overwhelming the system with the flash mobs, right? That's the reason for doing it, and But you've got a perfect storm here because you've got a DA or you've got a prosecuting attorney that says, well, we're not going to prosecute for this. All right, so then what they'll do is they'll get the flash mob together and they'll go knock over CVS or Shaw's or, you know, your local drugstore, whatever they're going to steal, you know, the local TV store, the hardware store, whatever the case may be.
So this is not a law enforcement problem.
Well, it's a law enforcement problem from a standpoint that, unfortunately, you know, we're going to get the call, hey, they're breaking into my store, and then unfortunately, we're going to go down there and say, yeah, they didn't, nothing they stole is over the $5,000 mark, so you get an insurance claim, you know, and man, I would hate to have to tell a vendor that. That would just kill me.
I just don't get it. I don't understand how these things get organized. Maybe because I've never been a part of one.
Go. I'll tell you. I had a friend of mine. He's retired now. Was a captain and later a chief inspector in the city of Philadelphia with the city of Philadelphia Police Department. For those folks who don't know, an inspector is actually pretty high in the police ranks. That's right up there next to, you know, chief. So he had this problem, and he and I spoke. He was also an FBI Academy graduate. He had gone a couple of classes in front of me. We were actually Army buddies. And in any event, he was dealing with the flash mob business down in Philadelphia, and they were trying to get their hands on that, and they were trying to crack down on that really hard, because he recognized the danger. And what you have is you just have these groups that are very loosely confederated, and through the advent of, you know, cell phone technology, right, they're saying, hey, flash mob in 10 minutes in front of you know, CVS Pharmacy on 3rd and 4th Street, and then, you know, you got 400 people show up, okay, let's go, and it's really that simple. And then they steal everything off the shelves, and
they're gone by the time you get there.
And they're gone. And think about, as you said, I mean, yeah, sure, you got all this video, and maybe even you got eyewitnesses that are in there, right? There's no way you're going to prosecute 400 people.
Yeah.
Right? Or even 60, right, that do that. And so you got to look at what causes the conditions for that. And I would say it's probably lack of prosecution.
Okay.
Right.
Well, it's not like there's lack of jobs.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Exactly. You just hit the nail on the head.
I mean, I understand that San Francisco is a hellishly expensive place to live.
This is the low. Yeah, but it's expensive. Yes, it is expensive. But you know what? You go to, you know, even if you're getting a job, you know, doing hard labor, digging ditches and, you know, for the city, for DPW, whatever the case may be, you're probably making $100,000 a year. All right.
Yeah, but you could work at an IHOP and make $30,000 a year.
You know? I bet you if you're working at an IHOP in San Francisco, you're not making $30,000. You're probably making $60,000 a year.
Yeah, with the tips and everything else, maybe you're right.
So remember, yeah, things are expensive. Things are expensive, sure. And when things are expensive like that, everybody's salary matches the, so it's the percentage. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
So when I came up here to be a police officer in New Hampshire, right, it paid a lot less than being a police officer in Massachusetts. But I had a better standard of living in New Hampshire, even though I was making less money.
Right.
Well, that's the reason why.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, because prices up here were a lot less expensive than they were in Boston or Cambridge.
What do you hear from the law enforcement community in those affected places by the shoplifting mobs? Yeah, are their hands tied politically? Are they doing their best?
Well, I think the answer is yes on that. From my friends that I know personally that are in those large cities, like New York City, like Philadelphia, like L.A. I got a buddy of mine that just left LAPD, and this guy's a Rhodes Scholar. He's a retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel. He and I were in Kosovo together. We're also Norwich grads, went to Norwich. And he just became chief of one of the harbor master for one of the towns south of San Diego on the coast. But he's got a very nice job. But yeah, they're burnt out. They you get good folks that leave because of the political climate, and that's really too bad. That's unfortunate. And the people that are going to suffer are the citizens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of the politicians are trying to, you know, I don't know. They're trying to, I think they're just caught up with the wrong philosophical dogma. and they have perceptions in their minds that are just simply not true. And as a result of it, they're trying to correct it through laws, but what they're not doing is looking at it with the right color glasses. So they have these perceptions that are driving their political decisions that are just inaccurate.
Like what?
Well, I think that a lot of them feel that the laws are racist.
That one I don't get, but okay.
All right, so I think that's part of it. That, you know, laws are racist. That, and then another perception is, well, these people are just stealing to eat. Well, no, that's not why they're stealing. I mean, in the United States, okay, when you compare, so compare the United States to, there's a comparison I hear all the time, to the Nordic countries.
Okay. Okay. Like Norway.
Norway, you know, Denmark.
Iceland, Denmark, okay.
You know, Holland.
Greenland, yeah.
You know, those Nordic-type countries, right? France, if you want to, you know, I know that's not a Nordic country, but it has a lot of social programs. The Nordic countries, if we call the Nordic countries socialists, right, that's a socialist country. Norway's a socialist country. Denmark is a socialist country. France is a socialist country. They will say, no, we are a republic. We're not a socialist country. And they will push back on that label really hard. Now, do they have certain social programs just like we do? Yes, they do. Yes, clearly they do. But in many respects, we are heavily regulated, more heavily regulated, and have a much more robust social safety net than those countries do. The United States, California, right? One need only look at Bill Maher and follow his program and podcasts. Bill Maher is death on California. He lives in California. He's death on California. He's been trying to get his solar panels hooked up for like the last 5 years now. Can't do it because California is so overly regulated. Businesses are leaving there in droves because they're so the state is so heavily regulated, and that's his point. His point is you can't open up a business here in California easily. It takes mountains of paperwork and teams of attorneys to get something approved. And this is exactly what we're talking about here. This is part and parcel of the problem, right? So in France or Norway or Denmark, look at how easy it is to open up businesses in those countries. Completely unregulated compared to the United States. Forget California, just cut out the anomaly. Compared to the rest of the United States, those countries have no laws, okay, when it comes to opening up businesses. When we look at the social safety net, those countries have less of a social safety net than the United States does on the poverty level. All right, I have acquaintances in Holland that don't have nearly the resources that they would have here if they were living in the United States. Being in the very low or lowest socially economic strata.
But yet I hear a lot of, well, they have better standards of living than we do.
Well, I think that's subjective and not objective. And that I would say, no, that's not true. The tax rate in those countries is, I think, is huge.
Yeah,
you know, you're talking, you know, upwards of 70% of their income goes to pay taxes of some flavor. They have value-added taxes and luxury taxes and everything else that are just brutal, So there's a trade-off there. So I don't believe that that's true. I don't believe that that's true at all. And you know, the grass is not always greener on the other side. But getting back to the United States, and the point I'm making here is that if you know, we have this very robust social safety net, okay? And I recognize that bad things happen to good people, and that's why we have that social safety net. And I would not be an advocate of getting rid of it. I think it needs to be reformed. I think there are better ways and methods to do it. But we have that for a very important reason. I don't think, I think as long as that, Americans are very magnanimous people and we're very generous. And sure, I know there's poverty out there. I know there are people that are hungry. I know that, but not nearly to the extent that there are in other countries. We have a very robust social safety net here in the United States. And I guess that's just that's just ultimately my point. So looking at this thing from the dogma, the political dogma, and trying to tie it all together, I think there's a lot of perceptions that are just not accurate. They believe perception is reality, right? I've heard that many times before. They believe that they're right, but they're not. And rather, they made these sweeping reforms that without talking with anybody, especially on the other side of the political spectrum, you know, again, things get done in this country when we compromise, right? But when you make these sweeping political changes that affect the laws and how they're enforced, it's really bad, and you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do that without at least sitting down and having groups study the problem and come up with some viable, sustainable solutions.
In our remaining minute and a half or so, what would happen if something like that kind of flash mob event happened in Wolfboro?
We'd be overwhelmed. Resource-wise, we'd be overwhelmed to deal with it.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? The same thing was true in Boston. If it happened in Boston, they'd be overwhelmed.
Yeah.
That's what's going on in Philadelphia and L.A. and New York City and Seattle, Washington, and everything else. They just don't have the resources. That's why it's a successful criminal method. Notice I said criminal.
Right.
It was a criminal method.
Right.
You're conspiring to break the law. That's a felony.
So if you could find them, so.
Right. If you can find them.
Right. I was going to say, is there artificial intelligence that can match the video against known photographs?
Well, I think there's all sorts of technology that can be used. But remember, you got to get the cooperation. You have to get cooperation from a lot of internet providers and cell phone carriers and so forth and so on in order to successfully prosecute these investigations. You're just not going to get that from Apple.
Yeah.
Or you're not going to get that from Google and
yeah.
and Verizon and other places. They're just not.
Well, thank you once again for coming in.
Thanks.
As always, a lovely chat.
Good.
Appreciate it.
Good.
Enjoy your week. It's 1 o'clock on WASR. News is next.